This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, August 25th, 2015. We start with the financial vertigo yesterday that it would be a challenge for even the wildest summer amusement park to duplicate. The Dow Index dropped more than 1,000 points at the open, then all indices rose hundreds of points in a whipsaw day that saw huge moves in minutes and even seconds. Was it machines gone wild? Was it fear of the instability in China? Was it computer algorithms trying to react to the conflicting signals out of China? Stephen Guilfoyle is a stock trader on Wall Street who described yesterday as dodging a bullet that might come back again.
Bordering on the edge of panic, but not really quite there yet. I was here back in 1987. You know, that was a much more dire feeling in the gut of our stomachs than what we got. It was bad, and it could go there, but it's not there yet.
Well, it was dire enough for the Chinese. They took their most aggressive action in weeks today, cutting interest rates and flooding banks with liquidity. Who will be satisfied by this move, and does it help China's investors to understand what is going on? Joining us now from Hong Kong is Patrick McGee, a reporter for the Financial Times. Patrick, how do Chinese investors react to this instability? Is it machines there in Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Beijing? Or is it more human beings that are being driven by what the Chinese government does?
It's very much mom-and-pop investors that drive the market in China. So there's not actually all that many fund management companies. You don't have the same sort of Vanguard and BlackRock sort of investing where, you know, you and I might put a portion of our paychecks into the market and just have it passively sit there for years on end without really even ever checking it except for the monthly statement or something. Instead, you tend to have a lot of people that will actually trade in the middle of the day and only hold shares for a few days. And as a result, turnover on the Shanghai Composite is actually often higher than it is in the U.S. market, despite it being significantly smaller.
So the Chinese government has this advantage is that they say something and investors will actually take those commands as gospel. And yet they delayed for so long in the last several days and China's markets really declined significantly. What explains that, do you think?
Yeah, so just to back up a little bit, basically 12 months ago, Beijing and the People's Bank of China started putting out these editorials through the state mouthpieces that the Chinese people read each morning in the financial papers saying that we want to have a stock rally and that, you know, you should be investing in your stock. This is the sort of way to wealth creation. And it was pretty clear that China was doing this in order to create a wealth effect, especially during a time when China needed some stimulative action. And they really backed up those words with policies over the coming months. And with every little step they took, it was interpreted as a move that Beijing really wanted the stock market to continue going up. The problem is it basically got to absurd levels. So the Shenzhen Composite, which is sort of similar to the NASDAQ in a way in that it's got a lot of tech-heavy stocks, it went up something like 190% in less than 12 months. And when it began to fall, People's Bank of China basically didn't know what to do about it. And so when they tried to take action to prop up the market again, they ran into all sorts of trouble.
So you've got a government that's good at inflating a bubble, but not terribly good at dealing with the deflation. And that's what's going on right now. How long-lived is the effect of the action taken today, do you think? A few days, weeks, or has they steadied it for a while?
Yeah, it's actually really hard to say, especially because you've got this herd mentality in the China market. But the reason why equities fell so dramatically on Monday and then again dramatically on Tuesday was because Beijing basically completely kept mum on what they were going to do, if they were going to do anything at all. And it very much sounded like they'd given up the idea of trying to prop up the market. To some extent, it was a little bit surprising that they did act today. But on the other hand, it's completely in line with what they've been doing the last 12 months or so. So it actually really depends on whether it's taken to be a panicky response, in which case you could actually have a further downfall, or if it's taken to be a sign that Beijing does have your back. The only thing I would bet on is that you're not going to see stability tomorrow. It'll either be another sell-off or more likely a very big rebound.
Well, to bring it back to the to the Western Hemisphere, if there's a herd mentality in China, does it make any sense for Wall Street to react to the herd? And if it's machines that are reacting, this would seem not something that their software can deal with.
It's a really good question as to whether or not Westerners should react to the fall in the China market. For the most part, I would say no. I mean, the China market is pretty isolated in a way. I mean, if you need to prove that the Chinese market is very disconnected from the Chinese economy, all you have to look at is the fact that last year, China had its slowest growth rate in 24 years. And what did the stock market do? It more than doubled. Now, people should really be paying attention to the economy. I mean, if China's economy is slowing, that means they're buying fewer, you know, semiconductors from Korea, automobiles from Japan, And so that's really what matters. And I think the reason why you had a panicky response on Monday is less because the stock market fell by 8.5% and more from sort of the more indirect thing that had people thinking, what does China know that we don't know? And is China on the brink of a greater fall? And what does that mean for the economy? And so it was a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to sort of get out of any exposure to China amid a little bit of chaos.
Patrick McGee, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Patrick McGee is a reporter for the Financial Times, speaking to us from Hong Kong. When we made it into the office of Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper yesterday to talk about innovation, the financial markets were in the middle of their whirlwind. The governor told us that cities and states have ways of insulating themselves from financial sell-offs by focusing on wealth creation in their own backyards. Hickenlooper says he sees opportunities right now and right here at home.
Certainly when you look at the global perspective, cities and states, but especially, and I think city-states, like metropolitan regions, have taken on a greater level of autonomy than they've ever had in modern history. And you see this in infrastructure, in how do you build transit systems, and how do you build up your technology sector. That happens really on a regional basis, more effectively and more efficiently. And especially now where, not just in Washington, but in capitals around the globe, there is this bitter partisanship, and maybe a function of how rapid change we've been going through over the last decade or two. And it creates great divides. And in that lack of a focused, consistent direction from national governments, there's a vacuum that cities and states are moving into. And I think by necessity, I think it's a good thing.
When you're in that vacuum, does the pragmatic discussion of real problems being solved, transit systems here in Denver, water problems and natural resources problems and environmental problems that you deal with in Colorado, does it force people to come to grips with the fact that they have to actually execute and get something done, and that's a positive?
Not always. We have our partisan issues as well, but in many policy issues, transportation, even healthcare to a large extent, you are able to navigate around the partisanship and really get to outcomes that bring different pie shapes of self-interest together. A lot of what we see happening in metropolitan Denver or in all of Colorado is, you know, folks rolling up their sleeves and saying, all right, we're not going to be divided on this. We're really going to focus on how do we get people to and from work more efficiently so they don't get stuck in traffic for all this time.
Would you say that that has helped to get voters to invest in the kinds of projects that we associate with the early and mid-20th century? You know, big dams, big development projects, the sort of FDR vision. I mean, you're not doing it on that scale, but certainly the transit system here in Denver is not something you can get voters to necessarily get behind in other places in the country.
If you were to look back over the last 30 years, in the mid-1980s, Metropolitan Denver agreed to have a regional sales tax, 0.1%, just for their cultural facilities. That's now about $45 million a year that goes to 250 small galleries or museums or theater companies. And that's that collaborative effort from the mid-80s. Then the mid-90s, we built DIA, the last major city to build a modern airport. It opened in 95. And then 2003, Fast Tracks, 119 miles of new track, the largest one-time transit initiative in the history of the country, 0.4% sales tax over the whole metropolitan region. So the West is a place where people had to work together to survive the elements. So there's this long history of collaboration. But on those big projects, it really does make a difference because you're building infrastructure for the long term that help future businesses but also attract young entrepreneurs.
So you're saying that the same people who are engaged in the cultural institutions feel like they have a stake in these big infrastructure projects because they sort of see themselves in the growth and what's interesting and wonderful about this community?
Yeah, I think they're all tied to the quality of life. And people talk, I mean, you hear all the time, you know, Colorado's 300 days of sunshine, the glorious Colorado Rockies, you know, all these incredible landscapes. But if you don't have the support for that, right, if you're stuck in a traffic jam for an hour and a half every day, you're not going to care so much how beautiful those Rocky Mountains are. There's this kind of this cultural center of gravity going on that also is very good for the business community. It attracts, for the last 6 years, we've been one of the top two destinations for millennials all over the country, and they're attracted to culture and music. So, and they do startups. Hmm.
Is there a danger that hipness and the presence of cranes all over the city will just become luxury apartments and not housing for middle and lower income, and won't benefit the fully diverse community.
Well, I think that that's the challenge in any rapidly growing community, is to make sure that all your citizens benefit. And we've put a ton of effort into early childhood education. Denver was the first city in America to pass a sales tax to make sure that every four-year-old could get high-quality access to early childhood education. But it doesn't sound like that big a deal, except no one else has ever done it. And I think housing ties right in with that.
So mass transit and this educational momentum you're talking about can be an antidote to gentrification, which is always a dirty word in high development growth, high growth cities.
Yeah, I think gentrification is, you want to protect neighborhoods and at least make sure that you reserve and find ways to reserve affordable housing in all parts of your city. But I am a firm believer that the transit becomes a great equalizer in allowing people from all parts of the community to be able to, regardless of their economic status, allows them to access jobs anywhere.
When Democrat John Hickenlooper became governor of Colorado in 2011, he took the huge changes he had made to the skyline of Denver as mayor, museums, libraries, performing arts centers, and mass transit, and began to think about how to make similar changes statewide. On his office, the walls are hung with huge tapestry-sized landscapes of mountain peaks. There's a Martin guitar standing in the corner signed, "To the Hick." And the governor's dog, Sky, wanders around, sometimes staring suspiciously at the full-size sculpture of a horse, the one thing Hickenlooper brought along with him from his stint at Denver City Hall. But nothing on the governor's bookshelf says Hick. There's the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, Aaron Ralston's Between a Rock and a Hard Place, titles that reflect an interest in business and the pitfalls of political leadership. One of Hickenlooper's first acts was to take all of the high-tech innovation centers around the state in agriculture, aerospace, media, and digital technology, and to get them to work together in a network. Colorado's Innovation Network, or COIN, is the only one of its kind in the nation. And during the week of the COIN Summit, he explained his vision of new thinking to us.
Well, innovation in its purest form is just anytime you do something in a different way, that's an innovation. Right? It doesn't have anything to do with technology. If you're trying to make sure that kids from low-income backgrounds have a better chance in life, and you use a sales tax to make sure that they have access to early childhood education, quality, that's an innovation. And I think the same thing can be done with housing. We're looking at part of COIN in the next 2 days is going to look at healthcare and how do we figure out ways to improve the quality of healthcare, because nothing stays the same, and if it's not improving, it's going to get worse. So you got to keep improving that. But how can we do it for less money and expand that coverage in a cost-effective way to make sure that everybody, that healthcare really is a right and not just a privilege?
Can you be a leader on climate change issues? We talked with Governor Brown last week in California, who's dealing with drought and fires and a very, very uncooperative climate looking forward with the population and the needs that they're going to have over the next 10 years. And yet some have said that Governor Brown hasn't grabbed on to the issue because there's caution associated with being too negative. What's your view? And we see the haze in the air here, and we talked with you recently about the floods in Boulder. Can you project political leadership in addressing climate change?
Well, certainly. I mean, although it is complex, and I think not without risk. In 2012 and 2013, we had some of the worst droughts in this state's history, and we had the two most destructive fires in our history. And then in September of 2013, the worst flood in the state's history. So I think when you talk about climate change, there is such a high variability in terms of how its effects are being received and how you see them. I mean, this spring and summer, we've had one of the wettest years in modern history in Colorado, certainly in the last 20 or 30 years. When you want to go out and talk about climate change, people around here are going to be saying, well, wait a second, we did have those droughts 2 years ago, and now suddenly it doesn't seem like that's part of climate change. Well, climate change obviously is a much broader phenomenon that has a wide amount of variability in the shorter time frames. So you have to kind of discuss it. You have to make sure that you're discussing it in that sense. When we talk about climate change, we don't say, well, it caused this specifically or that specifically. We say that, well, I say that when I've seen 15 of the last climate models I've seen, 14 of them show that Colorado's in a drought shadow and that we're going to have more droughts, and our droughts are going to be more severe. When you talk to farmers and ranchers, they've heard all the attacks against climate change, but you lay that out for them, and they're very thoughtful. Not easy to convince, but very thoughtful. And I think most of them recognize that, you know, some more solar and some more wind, that's a pretty good idea.
It's a short walk from the City Hall to the State House here in Colorado, and you've made that walk. It's a little farther of a distance to somewhere like, say, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Given the entertainment value of the current presidential campaign, what do you think about what's going on in the presidential campaign? And has Hillary Clinton called you and said, please, John, stay out of it for now?
No, she's never called me to make any ask like that. I will say the walk from the City Hall across what we call Civic Center Park to the state capitol, it's a short walk, but it's a pretty hard walk. I'm the first mayor of Denver to get elected governor in 150 years, or almost 150 years in Colorado. And there are reasons for that, right? The political dynamics is usually the suburbs against the city. Suburbs are usually more conservative. They align with the rural areas. We've really focused on trying to bring different sides together. When you look at that approach and how difficult it is in Washington and how almost impossible, I mean, you see that that walk to get to Washington, to Pennsylvania Avenue, would be all but impossible.
Well, are you ruling yourself out for 2020, 2024?
Yeah, I'm not. I've already said I'm not going to run. I've got 3.5 years left of being governor of Colorado, and I think we are. Part of our goal, when we talked earlier about states and metropolitan areas being the kind of the model for a new type of more successful governance, I think Colorado can be a real national model of how a state can run, how you can actually have a smaller state government over a period of years and yet do more for your citizens, embrace technology, and not have to do layoffs as the baby boomers retire, maybe replace them with a little technology and some fewer people. That's a model that I think really deserves a 3.5-year effort. And if we're any good, 3.5 years from now, people will be saying, wow, Colorado's not only the thinnest state, but it's the healthiest state. And it's the number one state for creating jobs and giving kids a fair chance at those jobs through a good education. I mean, that's our goal. So we want to be the model.
Governor Hickenlooper, thank you so much.
You bet.
That's Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper. We spoke to him from his office in the state capitol in Denver.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The story now of some very modern threats to residents of a traditional U.S. urban neighborhood. Philadelphia's Point Breeze neighborhood is seeing success and hearing angry views of the consequences of that success. Bobby Allen, a reporter for member station WHYY, says economic change has brought with it racial tensions that make a beer garden in Point Breeze not necessarily a place to cool down on a hot summer day.
Point Breeze is a historically working-class black neighborhood in South Philadelphia. It's, maybe a 15-minute drive from Philly's center city. And in the 90s, it was plagued with, you know, drugs and gun violence, and has been slowly springing back from that. But in recent years, the influx of new residents has really shaken up that dynamic. I mean, the neighborhood has been undergoing probably some of the most drastic and visible gentrification in Philly. And that's being fueled, of course, by whiter, younger, more affluent folks who are lured by close proximity to trendy neighborhoods, affordable housing options. I looked up the census figures, and, you know, in the last 5 years, the black population has dropped almost 10%. And if you walk around the beer garden, you'll notice that there's still a fair amount of blight. But, you know, talk to residents, and they say they've never felt change like what they're feeling right now.
It's already underlining smolder of tension between the people that's moving into the community and the established people that's been here.
Now, he talks like a sociologist, but he's actually a resident.
Yeah, that's right. He actually used to play basketball on the site of the beer garden many decades ago. Since then, it's really been a sort of derelict, empty lot. In fact, the Philadelphia Daily News wrote that, you know, before the beer garden, it attracted rock-throwing kids and drug dealers who hid their stash in the trash. So I don't think anyone is really longing for a return to the empty lot, but what replaced the empty lot really is symbolic.
And Larry Moore, that resident you described there, is talking about this tension of a neighborhood in change. But the developer, if you talk to the developer here, he reports that really the old days are what he's trying to get away from.
The trash-strewn lot with Magnum 357 shell casings and drug bags did fit the fabric of the community?
That's the way it was?
Yeah, you know, that's John Longacre. He says he's really trying to move the neighborhood forward, and not everyone agrees. Now, you know, some people do. It's really important to point out that in Point Breeze in Philly, gentrification battles like the one we're talking about now about this beer garden don't fall along perfectly neat lines. It's really a messy fight with a lot of subtle shades and confusion, and most of all, passion.
Well, here's a resident, Claudia Sherrod, who leads the nonprofit South Philadelphia Homes organization, and this is what she told you.
Reverse racism seems to be a factor here. Some of the people who are screaming and hollering, they think that you're taking something from them.
She's a 50-year resident, black resident of Point Breeze. She works with the poorest of the poor in the neighborhood. But she's actually a big fan of the developer behind the beer garden. When I talked to her, she said, sure, you know, he might be a developer, and that word alone might put a bad taste in the mouths of some longtime residents, but she says his heart's in the right place. And when she was talking about, quote, reverse racism there, she said if the developer was black, maybe there wouldn't be as much of a pushback. And that's a pretty provocative point, but that's, you know, how she feels.
Interesting. Well, black or white, Larry Moore, who we spoke to, is a resident of Point Breeze, talks like a lot of property owners when something like this happens. Listen.
I hope that you can afford to pay the tax increases that's about to come into the neighborhood, or prepare to leave the neighborhood.
Is this a pricing people out of the neighborhood that they have grown up in? Is that a phenomenon that we're seeing in Point Breeze yet?
The figures do bear this out. Sure, this might be a temporary seasonal enterprise that, you know, people will revel with their fancy IPAs and small batch beers, and it'll eventually pass. But it really does represent something that we see when we look at the census figures, which is the neighborhood is changing, it's getting more affluent, and longtime residents are slowly being edged out.
Change is controversial in a particular neighborhood, but it also brings smiles to some of the faces of the residents that you talked about. Great reporting. Bobby Allen is a reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks so much, Bobby.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, featuring personalized learning plans that help each member of the household achieve their learning goals, from anthropology to anti-aliasing to Arduino. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Now, I hardly need to convince you that this is entertaining.
Two-thirds of the state legislature has to vote to remove the flag.
Two-thirds! Two-thirds! No, that makes sense. You don't want to impulsively take down a 150-year-old symbol for an armed insurrection against the United States of America. Otherwise, I mean, it's mob rule.
Jon Stewart was funny and electrifying to watch because he was immensely talented. Also, satire and cynicism helped to identify and clarify problems in our political and personal lives. But comedy, cynicism, and raging frustration are also ancient stalling tactics built into our social behavior that keep us from confronting difficult problems. Joke now, solve problems later. Rant today about a coworker, but put off that really tough, honest conversation that might really change things as long as you can. Brené Brown, professor of social work at the University of Houston, has deeply researched our capacity to invent stories to keep us from seeing truths that may be threatening. Brené Brown, who has become a TED conference rock star, has a new book, Rising Strong, all about how we prefer our invented stories about ourselves to the vulnerable, scary process of learning who we really are when we fall and have to rise again.
Being ourselves in a world where who we're supposed to be and how we're supposed to be and what we're supposed to say and not say feels dictated every moment of the day is tougher than just be you. And there's a lot that we have to think about. We have to think about shame. We have to think about authenticity. We have to really understand the consequences and the delights of being who we are and being transparent. Most of us, I would imagine, were raised hearing, get out there and give it a try. At this very same time that most of us were raised to believe that vulnerability is weakness. And that's complicated because after, you know, 13 years of research, what I can tell you for sure is that vulnerability is actually our best measure of courage.
You begin this book with a story of something in your own relationship, in your own family, that starts out seeming like, oh, this kind of confessional, emotional story that we've read a million times, but you end up conveying just how much is at stake in every deep relationship, marriage, partnership, father-son, mother-daughter, mother-son. I've never really heard a story that tells how much is at stake every minute in the way that you told that story. What are the lessons you learned there at that crazy lake?
Here's the thing. Anytime we experience anxiety, anger, any kind of fall, it can be you and I walk out of a meeting and I say, hey, great meeting, John. And you look at me and you roll your eyes and you shrug and off you go. Just in a moment like that, even, our brain is hardwired to make sense of anything that it perceives as an emotional threat. And immediately what we do is our brain scrambles for a pattern or story to make up about what just happened so it can get some clarity on what's going to happen next. And so in that moment, my brain would scramble to say, you know what? I knew John never liked me. I knew he never trusted me. I knew he thought my ideas were bad. He didn't like what I said in that meeting. I just knew it. And when we come up with a story like that to explain something difficult, our brain loves it. It even rewards us. And then the show begins because emotion is in the driver's seat and thought and behavior are in the back seat, just following along. So the story in the lake was about a conversation Steve and I were having while we were swimming, where in 2 seconds, you know, he did something or said something, and I have this entire narrative made up about, you know, is our marriage okay? What does he think about me? And then I'm really angry and I'm going into payback mode. This is what we do. So those small minutes and those conversations, I mean, I can imagine asking how many listeners have ever been in a conflict with someone and then they walked out of the kitchen or they walked out of your office and you have an entire narrative made up, but you don't know what happened.
Tell me about the West Point officer who, in an experiment about people who are difficult in the office, who are frustrating to other people, and you tell them that, in fact, they're doing the best that they can, and they have to respond to that. This West Point officer, group leader, really took you to task, and it was an amazing result.
Yeah, I mean, the question leading this was, do you believe people are doing the best they can? And some said, well, maybe. And a couple said no. And this one man was like, absolutely not. People are not doing the best they can. And then I just said, you know, what if I told you, a person that you believe who works under you, who is not doing the best they can, what if I told you, in fact, they are. This person is indeed doing the best they can. What would that mean for you? And he got very emotional and he said, you know, it would mean move the rock. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, every day I work from the assumption that they're holding back and they're not giving the best because they're either trying to tick me off on purpose or they're being lazy. But if I heard without a doubt that this person is doing the best they could, then I would have to say, I don't think you can make a meaningful contribution in this position. Let's find one where you could. Instead of kicking the rock every day, I would have to move the rock.
Does your research actually suggest that in our brains we prefer to kick the rock and to hold on to our frustrations rather than have the more challenging conversations about maybe you need a different assignment or how can we improve this or you're making me angry?
It's a really interesting question because I think it actually goes back to vulnerability and our own unwillingness to be uncomfortable. Because the question becomes, what boundaries do you need to have in place in order to maintain your integrity and be generous with others? What we're not good at doing is we're not good at setting boundaries and holding people accountable. What we're better at doing is being resentful and angry and frustrated and wondering why people are trying to frustrate us on purpose, because that takes us out of the driver's seat of having to say, look, here's what works and here's what doesn't work for me, because that requires a lot of courage and vulnerability. And the possibility of not being liked.
What do you think the skills are here that will allow people to embrace this failure and come up with a language to have the kinds of revolutions within themselves that you believe that they can have to productively do the kinds of things that, you know, we're taught to be scared of?
I think, you know, we start like this process. I went into the research asking one question. What do men and women who suffer falls, heartbreak, disappointment, failure, those men and women who get back up from those and are even more courageous and have more tenacity, what do they have in common? And really the answer is they're willing to recognize emotion. They know when they've been hooked by something, and they're willing to get curious about what they're feeling before they respond. You know, in a weird way, they kind of hack the neurobiology of falling in the middle of it instead of just going with the worst case scenario and the blaming, angry scenario. They really stop and get curious and say, what do I know for sure about what just happened? And am I willing to really dig in to what's happening and what my response is?
Brené Brown, so much to talk about. The book is Rising Strong, The Reckoning, The Rumble, The Revolution. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it. Thanks, John.
And here's something to take with you today. Right here in Denver, you can smell, taste, and see the forest fires in the air. There's a haze that covers our view of Colorado's glorious mountain ranges. And when the wind blows just right, you can smell the forests burning. But they're not burning here. The smoke is from hundreds of miles away in California and the Pacific Northwest, Idaho, Montana, and Oregon. Australia and New Zealand have sent a team of firefighters over to the states to help the men and women already on the ground take on this fight in the West. The Army has also deployed resources. It's a small, fragile planet indeed. Big thanks again to Colorado Public Radio for looking after us, and we'll be broadcasting once again from the Mile High City tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA Gref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.